So tonight we have Jameson Lock talking about the challenges of implementing a multi-sig wallet in Ethereum. First, I'd like to say thanks to Ali and Kirby and the rest of the team for hosting us.
Well, welcome. Thank you for coming. My name is Kirby. I'm the event and programming manager here at Ali. Ali, for those of you who don't know, is a co-working operator here in this Verizon building. Ali is a change over here. We partnered with Verizon in this facility to operate the co-working space for the startup community. We're powered by Verizon's technology, their thought leadership, as well as their vast networks in their professional world. Our collaboration with Verizon allows us to develop our next level ecosystem for the startup community. If you want to know more about Ali and Verizon, you can come see me at the end at the back. We'll be more than happy to explain more about what we do here and what we're about, as well as the new tours. So we hope that you have a great time here, find great value here at this event.
And before we get started, I also wanted to say you were here at the last meetup and saw the voting DApp tutorial by Mahesh. He has a new tutorial on his site. It's for building a decentralized eBay. His site is astrin.com. It's E-A-S-T-R-I-N. So check it out.
Thank you. That's right. Okay. Oh, sorry, we have a set. All right. So, thanks for the introduction. I'm Jameson Lopp. I've been doing Bitcoin and crypto asset stuff for fun since 2012, but I've been doing it full-time as a software engineer for BitGo for about 2.5 years now. And it's been a wild ride. I never imagined that we would see such a proliferation of technologies happen so quickly in this space. And as Ethereum has risen to become a very popular crypto asset, BitGo, as a company that is really focused on securing any crypto asset of value against theft, seizure, loss, what have you, it eventually got to the point where we decided that it would be a profitable endeavor for us to offer our services for this asset. So, I guess you could say, I know a little bit about Bitcoin, but to be perfectly honest, this is my first ever presentation about Ethereum. It's the first time I've really talked about anything other than Bitcoin at a blockchain-type meetup. So I will definitely have a biased and skewed perspective from that point, but I think that it may be interesting to see a sort of an old-school Bitcoiner approaching Ethereum as such a vastly different technology from what we're used to. So to sort of start off and give a little bit of background about BitGo and what we do. One of the reasons BitGo exists is because crypto assets are very difficult to secure. So you can think of Ether as a bearer instrument. Whoever has the keys can control what happens with that Ether. And there's a reason why you see bearer bonds show up in movies and stuff. It's because they make for very compact and untraceable high-value targets for theft. Now, if you think about Ether, it is incredibly value-dense. It can be stolen remotely. You don't even have to go into a bank or any other target with physical security that might hurt you or throw you in jail if you screw up. This is really a thief's dream. And also, the transactions on Ethereum and generally most crypto asset networks are irreversible. So if you manage to get in, if you manage to find one little flaw, one hole that allows you to get those private keys and move them to an address that you control, that's it, game over, you win. Now, you could say that this is one of Ethereum's greatest strengths, since payments can be considered final by the recipient. But it's also one of the most challenging attributes to deal with from a security perspective. We have some other semi-irreversible systems and traditional payments, such as Fedwire, but they're rarely completely irreversible because there's usually a small number of parties that are controlling that network. They usually have some sort of agreements with each other where they can reverse erroneous transfers in many cases. So what is the end result? Well, crypto assets are the most slippery substance that we've ever seen since Teflon. And that's because it can be taken in a matter of milliseconds remotely by an attacker with little to no hope of recovery. And so what you see most of the time in crypto assets is a single key securing of that asset. Meaning you have the user, they have a key, and with that key you can create your Bitcoin, your Ethereum, or whatever transaction. And once that transaction is out on the network, it gets confirmed, and there is no going back. So the best way to get really high security for crypto assets is to take it offline. Use a cold storage offline wallet, print out a piece of paper, put it in a vault, put it in a physical bank vault. Physical security is a very well-known and well-understood problem. When you can bring crypto or cybersecurity back into the realm of physical security, you're in pretty good hands. But unfortunately, in order for these type of assets to really have utility and have value, we have to be able to move them around. We have to be able to spend them. And so you see sort of hybrid solutions come out, especially with big exchanges and any entities holding large amounts of value, where they will have a hot wallet and a cold wallet. And the hot wallet will have a little bit of the money, and the cold wallet will have most of the money. And this is good because it reduces the aftermath of what happens if you do get hacked. You always lose a percentage of your money. But there's some downsides. And generally that means that you've got all of your customer funds pooled together into a single target that if it gets hacked, you then lose that percentage of all your money. And then you also have to basically deal with a lot of operational issues like moving money from the hot wallet to the cold wallet, or even worse, moving money from the cold wallet to the hot wallet, which is going to be a much bigger pain from an operational security perspective. So what we do at BitGo is we try to offer a secure hot wallet so that you don't necessarily need a large cold storage offline wallet. So how do we do that? We use a technology called multisig. Multi-signature transactions and interactions, a fairly easy concept to understand. It just means that you say, okay, we have a group of this many people, and this number or this percentage of them needs to sign off in order for any given transaction to be valid. So if you're not really familiar with this type of model, what it does is it eliminates single points of failure. You see that you go from single key to multi-key. So in this case, you've got your user, and BitGo likes to do 2 out of 3, for a number of reasons I won't go into. But we then have 3 keys. The user has 2. They keep one of them offline as their recovery mechanism. And then BitGo is the oracle with the 3rd key. And when the user wants to create a transaction, they use their online key to sign, half sign the transaction, they send it to BitGo. BitGo then can go through any number of arbitrary security policies and other security mechanisms that the client has set up beforehand, and then decide whether or not to co-sign the transaction. If any of the security mechanisms fail, if any alarms go off, BitGo refuses to sign, we then alert the customer, hey, something's wrong. We might need to have like a human face-to-face chat to figure out what's going on, but prevents erroneous transfers because we can't stop them. But we cannot unilaterally freeze someone's wallet because BitGo only has 1 key. So from a regulatory standpoint, BitGo is not a custodian. We are just a software service. If the user ever wants to go around without using BitGo, they can just go get their other key, create a transaction without ever touching our service. So it creates a very interesting business model that we've been able to capitalize on, first with Bitcoin, and now with many other technologies, Ethereum, Ripple, Litecoin, Ethereum Gold, which is our own blockchain that we've been developing. And we can quickly go through some of the risks of these different models here. Basically, if the user holds the key, then there's a number of things that can go wrong. Basically, anything that goes wrong on the user side, whether intentional or unintentional, and they lose their money. They might not lose it to someone else. They might just lose it to the blockchain for all eternity. Users are not going to be security experts. Users are not going to be tech experts that have good IT practices and have multiple redundant backups in various locations to protect from catastrophic loss. But on the other hand, when you have a third-party provider like Coinbase or any number of exchanges or services that you make deposits into, they have the keys. And that means you've got pretty much all of the same type of risks that third party could have, but you also have to worry about them potentially lying to you. They're probably a bigger target for hacking because they're a public relevant entity. They could have regulatory problems. They could still have data loss. And of course, phishing, the human element, really is one of the biggest problems that we find in this space. But if we switch this to an AND, where you say you have a 2 out of 2 multi-sig solution, where the user has a key, service has a key, this starts changing the model, and we can actually get rid of a number of different things here. Basically, because if anything gets screwed up on the user side, then the service can stop bad transactions from happening. if anything screws up on the services side, then the user can say, no, you know, I don't consent to that, I'm not going to sign off on the transaction. I'm going to prevent, you know, theft from happening. But you still got data loss problems. If anyone on either side loses the data, then you lose the money to the blockchain for all eternity. But what if we change it to a 2 out of 3 model? Well, you can actually get rid of some of these data loss problems, because now you have a redundant third key floating around out there. You can go retrieve that key, and really, now you've eliminated everything except the human problem. And so I would say, like, these days, BitGo's biggest thing that we are trying to work on is the same thing that anyone in any security space is working on, which is the human problem. And humans are always going to be a problem, so I think anyone who's in the security space has got pretty good job guarantee. So, what do I do? This is basically what I have in my brain most of the days, or at least before I started getting into Ethereum. And this is just a sort of graph of what Bitcoin transactions look like. In Bitcoin, we don't have account balances, we just have transaction inputs and transaction outputs, and then you have to sum up all of the addresses on all the different unspent outputs in order to find the balance, keep everything up to date. So basically, I am responsible for running the infrastructure team at BitGo. We are responsible for indexing all of the various blockchains, keeping all our databases up to date with the current status of transactions and blocks. And basically, we provide the services that the wallet engineers at BitGo then hook into to get their data to figure out, like, what is the current state of a given wallet. But it gets a lot more interesting when we start using Ethereum. So BitGo has actually tried not once, but twice to build a multi-signature Ethereum wallet. The first time around was a little over a year ago, and we ran into some software stability issues. Basically, our first attempt at doing a infrastructure for Ethereum wallet, we decided to use Ethereum J. And the reason that we did that is because we were using Bitcoin J for our indexing solution, our original Bitcoin wallets. And Ethereum J is basically a fully functional node that runs the Ethereum virtual machine. It parses every transaction that's out on the network, parses all the contracts. And this ended up being a disaster for us, mainly because it wasn't production quality. At least it wasn't in 2016. I don't think it's that much better. Last I checked on it, I think some of the lead devs actually left, and it's not really getting as well maintained as a lot of people would probably like. But suffice to say, we were experiencing crashes and consensus failures left and right, poor documentation, not very good developer support from the Ethereum J folks, and so we never really even got out of the testnet situation, because our entire Ethereum J node and indexing service would continually get stuck or get corrupted, and the solution that was often presented to us was, oh, delete everything and just, you know, resync from the beginning, you know, turn it off and turn it on again. And that was not something that we were really willing to go into a production environment with, where people have real money at risk. So we ended up kind of shelving the version 1 of the Ethereum product right around the time when there were, like, a lot of network attacks going on. We basically figured, like, the entire environment was not quite stable enough for us to be able to put our seal of approval on it. Now, our second attempt at building Ethereum infrastructure, which we really started at the beginning of this year, we completely changed around pretty much everything that we were doing at a low level. So instead, what we're doing now is we're using Parity as our full node, which, from everything that we can tell, is, like, the most robust, most reliable, and most performant node that is out there for Ethereum. It is written in Rust. And instead of having the EVM running inside of our service, we're then just running it standalone, and we're using the RPC, the JSON RPC API, to talk to a Parity node and suck the data out of it, which we can then parse inside of our indexing service. This is, it worked a lot better for us from a performance standpoint. Though it's not been completely foolproof, I will say that Parity has crashed a few times, but only about 1/100th as often as Ethereum J was crashing on us. And this was mainly happening with like 1.6.3 version. And I actually had one of these crashes happen today and noticed, you know, 1.7 is out. So upgraded to 1.7 and I got my fingers crossed that they hopefully fix this particular crash bug that we've been running using. Next very interesting problem is Ethereum uses 256-bit numbers and 256-bit arithmetic. Let's see, here is the explanation, I think, from one of the Ethereum wikis about why they chose that. Suffice to say, you won't have to upgrade that for a very long time, but it causes some issues when you're trying to actually store and parse and perform operations on this numeric data. So, if you're hoping to store production quality database numeric types that you can query in interesting ways, like basically with mathematical operators, greater than, less than, range, whatever, you're going to have some problems if you're taking these huge numbers and just dumping them into the database. So what I've got here, these are a few Mongo queries, which is a database that we use for a lot of things. And so here, everything in Ether is actually in units of way, which is, I don't know, quite a few digits of data and precision. And so, you know, when you're sending a one Ether transaction, you're actually sending, I think this is 8.2 Ether. So you're actually sending like one and then this many zeros worth of value at the network level. So you can see here we inserted the data, but unfortunately, Mongo only supports like so much precision, and we've actually cut it off at like 2-3, and lost a little bit of precision. So then when you want to start, you know, having other transactions come in, updating balances, you know, add another one Ether to it, that has a little extra precision, well, we just truncated that too, and we're going to round it up to 4. And that might not seem so bad in one transaction, but what we found very quickly is that when you're parsing, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of transactions, those little rounding errors start to add up, and the balances in the wallet start to get off by noticeable amounts. So, the first time around, we tried to do something a little bit novel and crazy because while we found that Mongo and a lot of other production databases support 128-bit precision numbers usually in their largest number formats, with Mongo, actually, the Node.js driver that a lot of our applications use, which is called Mongoose, it has another limitation to it where it actually only supports 32 bits. And so that's you know, a much smaller amount of data that you can actually reliably transport back and forth. So what we ended up doing was creating this library that we call like the BitGo Bit Number Library that would chunk up, you know, each 32 bits of data and into its own object and then store that in separate fields. And then we can perform atomic operations on it because our indexers tend to be multi-threaded. We want to be able to get through the work as quickly as possible and update everybody's balances within a matter of milliseconds so that nobody complains about lag time. But that ended up being pretty complex and we actually ended up ditching it on our second time around just because the complexity tends to be the enemy of security and reliability. So the second time around that we implemented the infrastructure, what we decided to do instead is we changed our indexer to only be single-threaded instead of multi-threaded. And we were able to do this because we were no longer actually running the EVM in the indexer. We were letting the full node do all the work. And then we found out some novel ways that we could basically, as we were sucking the transaction data out of the node, throw away 99% of it. We essentially were looking for fingerprints of the Ethereum smart contract, the bits that our multi-sig smart contract is doing, and saying, hey, if there's none of these bits in this transaction, we don't care about it, throw away, and don't try to parse it. So that gave us like several orders of magnitude of speed up on our indexer, even though we went from a multi-threaded operation to a single-threaded operation. The additional thing that this allows us to do is that because we're not doing multi-threaded inserts and updates on the database, we no longer need to have atomic operations. So what we'll do instead, which sounds kind of dumb, but it works, is we just store these as strings. So we put the string in the database. If we need to update it, we read the string back out, turn it into a big integer, manipulate it, and put it back in. And you can do that very quickly if you're not having to do this in high rates, and you don't have to worry about multi-threading. Your different threads basically stacking on each other and screwing up the values. So the downside to that is that now that they're string values, you can't really query on them as if they were numeric values. You can't do ranges or greater than less than stuff. But we managed to avoid having to do that just by keeping those limitations in mind while we were building the wallet itself. And of course, as a security company, we were very worried about the low-level security of the smart contract itself. Here's actually a link to our smart contract. It's open source. If there are any Solidity developers out here, please feel free to give it a look. Here are some of the wallet features that you can actually find listed on that GitHub, some of the various things that it supports. And one of the biggest differences between Bitcoin and Ethereum, or really simple crypto asset security versus smart contract security, is that this multisig stuff is not native. Like, it's not part of the protocol itself. We have to build the multisig operations using the Solidity functionality in the protocol. So it's a lot more open and prone to problems, because rather than having an entire ecosystem of developers who have been looking at this and auditing it and trying to break it, it's really only us and our small team and then the various other companies that we have do audits on contracts. So it was a big point of contention for us that, you know, we've been working on the smart contract for over a year now, this continual iteration, three different official paid audits, and I don't even know how many unofficial volunteer audits that have come in of it. So just wanted to highlight one of the interesting pieces that came up here. And do we have any Solidity developers in the house? Okay. Oh, so you're all up front, so you can read it. That's great. Okay. So this is one function from the multisig contract that Bingo was running. And I just put this down here so that you can see that, like, the recent SQL IDs and assigners and stuff are local variables in the smart contract itself. So, and I'm not a Solidity developer, so I'm not an expert on this, but do you see any problems with this? Don't worry, I'll tell you the answer. So there are, in fact, several different problems. This is the original version of this try-insert sequence ID. So if you're somewhat familiar with Ethereum, you may be aware that instead of having like inputs and outputs like Bitcoin, instead you have an account and you have nonces. And that's the way that you kind of keep track of the ordering of transactions from an account, is that you have a nonce and you increment it every time you make a transaction. And so within the BitGo multisig smart contract, we have our other type of nonces, the sequence IDs, just to keep an order of the transactions and events that are happening in that wall. Now, there are two different problems with this function, which is basically trying to find the next good sequence ID that the wallet can use. The biggest flaw is that a compromised assigner can actually call this function with almost any value that they like. So it says only signer, but what it is missing is that it doesn't have a private declaration. And this, if you you heard about the parity of multi-sig contract problem. That was the same problem that the parity had, where they were not properly protecting. And so it turns out, I guess, that functions and splitting contracts are like public by default.
Yeah, like often what happens is like the last one's secure, and then you refactor like something out of like higher level function calling it out, it's just public and it's like it's exposed or that like the show point.
Yeah, so this is like one potential thing I think would be really easy for Ethereum as an ecosystem to make this better, is to like default all of your functions to private scope, because really any default in any type of computer system is going to be one of like 80 or 90% of people end up using. So if you default everything to public, that's probably not the best security practice. The main problem that this results in, though, is that you see there's all these various checks of sequence ID to make sure that we're not reusing a sequence ID and that we're not going backwards lower than a previously used sequence ID. That's the check right there, lower than. What it's missing is it doesn't have a sanity check for the highest possible sequence ID. So what we found was that while this is a multi-sig contract, at least when you're trying to create a transaction, this particular event is only requires a single signer on it. Because the original person who's creating the transaction, which is going to be the client in the case of BitGo, is going to be needing to figure out what the sequence ID is, you know, before they even have signed the transaction and send it over to us. So the problem becomes, now, if any client of BitGo's who was using this got compromised and the hacker got into their system, they could actually broadcast this event with a max int value of sequence ID. And while the hacker would not be able to steal money from the wallet, they have now locked the wallet for all eternity. Because you can never create another transaction with a higher sequence ID, these checks right here, make sure you can't do that. So what we ended up doing was we now have a few extra lines of code right here that say you cannot create or use a sequence ID that is more than 10,000 higher than the most recently used sequence ID. And that should be fine for pretty much the foreseeable future, because the maximum integer value is something insane. You know, grains of sand on the beach add up to the universe that would say. So now we have prevented the ability for a single compromised signer to completely lock the wall for all eternity.
Question?
Sure.
What is this function supposed to return?
What is it supposed to return?
Is it doing? Like, where does that look right here?
Yeah, so it should be returning, well, let's see. It does say return new ends. Maybe I left something out, but I would imagine it should be returning the sequence ID. That should be the unit that gets returned, though. Yes. Yeah. So I might have truncated. I might have truncated something, but it should definitely be returning the sequence ID. And what we have here is now going up a level. This is really more of what I see on a day-to-day basis. This is the JSON RPC command for asking for the transaction receipts for a specific transaction in Ethereum. And so the service that I write is basically pulling these transaction receipts, looking at all the logs, looking at the topics of the logs, which are essentially unique fingerprints, unique hashes of the contract events, and says, you know, is this a hash of an event that might be a BitGo wallet? If so, let's, you know, dig into it, analyze it a little bit deeper, figure out whether or not it's something we actually need to, you know, update our database with. And while it's relatively easy to write the apps in Solidity, I found that parsing the events that these apps are outputting is not quite as easy. So my first approach, even in the second go-round, where we had basically gotten rid of Ethereum for Ethereum J for our indexer, was I tried to use Ethereum J to parse the contract's ABI which is basically the description of the contract that it submits. And then I wanted to basically use that functionality in Ethereum J to hand it the transaction receipts and then have it give me the values that were resulting from it. Because if you look at what we're getting back from the JSON RPC API, these are the values that are being outputted from smart contract events, which, you know, it's hexadecimal encoded data, which has no meaning really to anyone other than the people who wrote the contract and know how to parse it, or they have the API which describes how to parse it. But unfortunately, I found that for some reason, and I never really got a clear answer on this, whenever the Ethereum J functionality was trying to parse the big integer numbers, it just continually mingled them and screwed them up. So after many frustrating hours of experimenting and trying to get Ethereum J's parser to work, what I actually ended up doing, which also sounds really dumb, but I am now parsing the 32-byte word chunks manually. And I'm saying, okay, Java, I give you the first 32 bytes of this data, and you transform it into a number, because we know that number represents this. It get the next 32-byte chunk, and that number represents like the value that was sent out. And it's kind of clunky, it's hard-coded and messy. I really would have preferred to use something that was actually ingesting the contract API, but that's the only way that I've gotten it to work so far, which is unfortunate. But if it works, it works. Additionally, what we found is that it's very easy in Bitcoin to say, okay, the money came from this address. You look at the inputs of the transaction and say, okay, these are the addresses that sent the money, these are the addresses that received the money. All you have to do is look at the inputs and outputs. But in Ethereum, this is actually simpler in Ethereum for standard transactions. A standard transaction with Ethereum has a to, a problem, address, and that's that. Not really anything interesting to parse. However, when you start doing smart contract stuff, it gets really insane, especially if your contracts are really complex. And so the BitGo multi-sig contracts have a function called the forward address function. And basically what we have at forward is because our various exchanges and other clients, they have who knows how many users that they need to assign a distinct deposit address to. And just having one deposit address is going to cause mass confusion for them because they won't know who is sending them money. So we have an event that you can do which will create a contract address, which you can then assign a user. The user sends to that forward address, and then the smart contract says, okay, I received the money to the forward address, and I'm going to actually send it into the main wallet contract address to pull all the money together. But now that means you have two different events, if not more, that are getting emitted, and you have to start being able to trace the money back to like the original transaction that did the deposit. It gets even crazier when you realize that it's possible for attackers to go out on the network and start creating their own versions of the contract that put out similar events that could potentially confuse your service if you're not being really careful about how you're parsing it. You can even have like people sending forward addresses to other forward addresses. And essentially, we had to spend a lot of time figuring out how to lock that all down to make sure that people couldn't confuse our service to make us think that we got like a double deposit, even when we didn't, because then, because the money goes into a pool power wallet, they might be able to convince an exchange to allow them to double withdraw. And that would be no good. We don't want anybody running curve on our watch. So while I don't really work at the smart contract level itself, I've also been told that actually debugging the smart contract can be pretty tricky, because most of the time when our developers go and look at the errors that are coming out on the blockchain, they just see stuff like bad jump destination. And I guess we've seen that as well, where the debugging of the Solidity contracts is like a whole new world. And don't ask me for help with that, because I will be up there. So, Ethereum has become very popular. And because every blockchain-based system sucks at scaling, when it gets really popular, you end up with a lot of backlogs on the network. So Bitcoin has been popular beyond its capacity for a year or two now. We have become very well-versed in how to deal with that. One of my other responsibilities is actually the de-estimation algorithms. That's a particularly interesting problem trying to predict the future. And the backlogs on Ethereum, however, are very new, which means it's a lot more painful because people are having to figure out how to navigate this new environment. Now, one of the differences kind of between Bitcoin and Ethereum is that when you have a backlog on Bitcoin, you can do a few different tricks, like you can change your UTXO selections and not select unconfirmed outputs. You can start doing stuff like child pays for parents, or like increase the priority of the outstanding transactions that are unconfirmed. But on Ethereum, when you're having to do smart contracts that are posting events to the blockchain, now you can potentially get a new type of backlog that can cause your users to actually at least temporarily lose some of their money. So like one of the biggest problems that we ended up having to deal with early on is that when a user initially created a wallet, that actual creation has to go out onto the network as a contract creation transaction. Normally, Ethereum block times are only like 17, 18, 20 seconds, whatever. That's not a big deal. But when you have some ICO going on that is, giving you a 6-hour backlog on the network if you're not paying like really high gas prices, then you've now got a uninitialized wallet that's just sitting there for potentially hours. And what we found happens is that if you then display the wallet to the user, they immediately start depositing money into it. But if they're doing that, then they're actually sending money to an address that, as far as the Ethereum network is concerned, has no smart contract behind it. It's just going into some address. The Ethereum network isn't parsing that as anything. It is not, there is no smart contract that exists to then fire the appropriate events that our service would then say, okay, you just got a deposit or whatever. So while our contract does have the ability to flush these funds, like once it finally gets initialized, what happens is that the indexer service, the other low-lying stuff, did not receive any events, did not parse any of those transactions, and so you now have an incorrect balance where you have more money in the wallet than our application is actually displaying to you. So what we've had to do is add extra logic that basically prevents the user from being able to even see the deposit addresses until we receive a confirmation that that particular wallet contract has been confirmed on the blockchain and will now start flowing the appropriate events. There's also the knots issues. We have to be a lot more careful about making sure that we're not skipping knots. That we, if you have one transaction that gets stuck out there for a really long time, that it may eventually time out, and then we don't want to continue trying to create higher and higher knots without fixing the knots that got screwed up. And this is actually very similar to Bitcoin in the sense of you can create like long chains of unconfirmed transactions that are spinning each other, and eventually you hit a limit where the Bitcoin network just rejects everything. So a similar type of headache on both of those networks. But really, it's like the address generation is one of the very different things where with most dumb crypto asset networks where you're generating addresses, you can generate a million addresses very quickly, like in a matter of seconds. You do it completely offline. The blockchain doesn't even know about them. And if you never use them, that's fine. No network resources get consumed. It's a very private operation. It doesn't really cost anything other than a little bit of CPU time. However, when you're generating an address with like forward address functionality, like I was talking about, you have to put a transaction out there, you have to wait for it to get confirmed before you can then allow people to safely send money to them. And it's not just that this takes time, it takes network resources, it takes real money. I think the last time I checked, it costs the equivalent of like $1.50 or something to create one of these addresses. Whereas in Bitcoin, it literally creates nothing, or costs nothing other than a few milliseconds of CPU cycles. So it also has a similar problem of where the user can't send to it, or if they send to it, they will have a wall with them. That's not completely correct. So just another sort of blocking issue where you have to hold the user's hand, prevent them from shooting themselves in the foot, because they don't necessarily know that all this additional work is happening in the background. And this is kind of the high-level recommendations that I'm saying I've really come to appreciate. And we have a few celebrity people in here. I would say you should definitely review our contracts. And if you find any problems with it, we'll pay you. Because if we don't, and this just goes across the board like for computer security in general, but especially crypto assets, if you're not offering a bug bounty program, you just don't know that you're offering a bug bounty program. Because your entire application becomes a bug bounty program. As soon as you start putting money into these things, you're basically saying, I'm making a bet that the security level of my entire application is able to secure this level of value. If you get to like millions of dollars of value, you start attracting a lot of attention, you start attracting the really smart people out there, and you might even start attracting other Ethereum developers who are better at Solidity programming than you are. So better to find those people ahead of time, offer to pay them money to look at your code and tell you if you screwed anything up. I only talked about a few of the many, many issues that were discovered in our Solidity contracts. If you find any others that you think could be used to either lock or take possession of funds against someone's will, shoot me an email. And what I've done is I've used the Open Timestamp service to put a hash of all of our audits to our contracts into the Bitcoin blockchain so that I can prove that these are the things that have already been discovered. And if you discover something that's not already in that list, we will most certainly be willing to pay you for that disclosure. So, there's a number of different things, but most of these are like general good computer programming, cybersecurity practices. Keep things simple. The more complexity you add, you might feel like, oh, Solidity is such an easy programming language, I can do all this cool functionality. But the more functionality you add, the greater the potential attack surface. The greater the number of potential vulnerabilities, where, like I said, someone only has to find one exploit, and then you might lose everything. So, audit all the things, use the test networks. Test networks tend to be even crazier than main networks. In terms of the fee issue stuff, the timing issue stuff, actually, the main networks end up being a better test there. You're generally not going to see transaction backlogs on the various test networks. So it's good to take a little bit of value and do some testing on the main network before you do a full pledge or a general availability release. And if anyone finds a better way to do this numeric value manipulation, we'd probably be willing to pay you to tell us how to do that too, because it would save us a lot of headache. So if you have any questions, I'm willing to do my best to take them. Like I said, I'm not a low-level Ethereum expert, but definitely security-related stuff or general stuff. Otherwise, I'm ready to socialize. Yes.
Any kind of. how do you find a good auditor?
So there are, I know we had, you know, at least three different audits, and looking, it really comes down to reputation, right? But I would say that like every audit that we've had done, like, it's been, you know, for people with a different perspective, they found things that the others didn't find. I'm a big fan of the guys at Open Zeppelin. They did a very thorough review, and I know we've actually got a blog post draft of the audit itself, which hopefully will get released before too long. And I know Sergio Werner also took a look at our stuff and found one or two things. In general, I think the best auditors are probably like the level minimum Ethereum developers and Solidity programmers. I mean, you're probably not going to be able to get Vitalik to audit your code, but the White Hat hacker group would also be interesting if we could somehow get them to like offer audit services. Like, I would really like to see that. I tried feeling around through the community to see if I could get in touch with them. But that would be something that I would be interested in seeing. Yeah.
So I'm new to the political language. When you are developing an algorithm, how do you kind of foresee these kind of edge cases, externalities, that it's not due to bugs in the code, but just scenarios that you didn't foresee, and now your code's out there, how do you catch it? How do you think about, oh, gee, you know, this is the next thing, you know, in this world, decentralization?
Yeah, so I think that there is a concept of versioning built into our particular Ethereum smart contract. I will say it has a safe mode feature, and so, you know, people have been writing more and more Solidity apps and storing and protecting more and more value with them, especially over the past year and a half, 2 years. A number of best practices have come out of that. You know, one of the things I think is to like not use the call function, for example. Another thing is, of course, the scoping, public private stuff. But from a like more general standpoint, coding defensively and giving your smart contract like an out, you know, a way to like safely stop executing everything except like one safely known code path, has become one of the more important things. So the Bitco smart contract has a safe mode where I think basically all you have to do is have one signer sign a transaction to execute the safe event. And what that does is it locks out every function on the smart contract except withdrawal to an address of one of the owners of the contract. So that's kind of the, like, you know, mash the red button, something has gone terribly wrong. Type of things. I really think that, like, every smart contract needs to have some sort of ripcord, if you will, just a way to safely stop operating in case of those unforeseen scenarios. Then, at least at that point, the only thing that you're still vulnerable to, I guess, would be like a really, really low level Solidity bug network operation that hasn't been fully understood yet. At which point you're talking more of a, like, we're upgrading the whole Ethereum ecosystem type of problem.
You mentioned that in CrossFit, you're on the 1.5 dollars to use the common one to use the time of the competitor. It's more than 1.5.
Yeah. For like, why does it cost $1.50? Also, and I'm not a big expert on the, like, the gas pricing mechanisms, but so, like, each of these blockchain networks has to have different ways to essentially protect itself from denial of service attacks. And that can be, of course, any number of things, but the specific denial of service attack here that we're worried about is just transaction spam. It's like, you don't want someone to just be able to fill up all of the data, like block space available on a network, and not pay anything to do it. So in Bitcoin, you have transaction fees, and they compete with each other in a sort of free-floating fuel market to get, you know, hot priority confirmation from the miners. And in Ethereum, you're paying gas, which is going to be related to the various computational steps that you're executing. And so when someone fires that create forward address event, that has to do a certain number of units of computation, and those get priced in a certain way. And that the gas itself is set in the protocol, but then the price of the gas is kind of its own flea market. And so the more and more people are then buying to get their transactions confirmed in Ethereum, they're then going to be competing on what the price of the gas is that they're willing to pay. And I know, like, we haven't done a whole lot of key estimation work yet for Ethereum. That's probably, you know, going to become an eventual thing that we also have to deal with. These days, I think we're just trying to set a fairly competitive fees because we want, due to all the reasons I disclosed before, we want these events and these contracts to get confirmed as quickly as possible so that they're then usable by the people to make deposits and start doing other things. So it's really like the question of, like, what is the cost to get to ram through all the current network congestion to get yourself up near the top of the line so that you get confirmed in a block is fairly soon. Yes.
You mentioned that the Ethereum KP would be the most stable terminal implementation, right? Did you get a chance to look at the Go or C++ implementations?
The GAS implementation?
Yeah.
And so, you know, GAS, I think, is the gold standard for the nodes. So last I checked, I think 80% or so of Ethereum nodes were running GAS. And I think it's stable and it's pretty good. But from just the chatter that I've been hearing in various like Slacks and communications channels for Ethereum developers and services that are running Ethereum, especially when all of the transaction network backlog happens, I've been hearing a lot more complaints from people about their death nodes becoming really slow, crashing in some occasions, usually like flooding out of RAM type situations. I mean, I think it would be fine in general. Most of the problems that I've heard of seem to be related to the SYN queue in GATH, where if you are a high transaction volume service and you're sending, you know, tens of thousands of transactions a day and they all get backed up in your local GATH SYN queue, I think you can have some problems there. But we have not yet ramped up, you know, anywhere near that volume. So I can't say for certain that the parity doesn't also have some related problems, but so far so good. I think we only really have a few customers that have deployed their Ethereum wallets so far. But stay tuned. I mean, this is a fast-moving, exciting space, especially in Ethereum, where really pushing the envelope pretty often, breaking stuff, fixing it, breaking it, fixing it. There are a number of service providers, especially the ones who have to deal with various ICO stuff, who have been under a lot of workload, both physically, mentally, and emotionally, over the past 6 months or so. Yeah?
I was wondering why you chose Mongo for your business.
Mostly legacy. The same reasons why a lot of startups, like, they start off with the meme stack because it's easy to get up and running. But really, like, we found over the years that even while I think a lot of developers might laugh at the idea of having, like, production quality JavaScript, it's actually possible. You just have to have, you know, really, really good testing, full test coverage. The performance has been scalable for our needs. Mongo has scaled well for our needs, especially the indexer stuff. And with the account-based Ethereum indexing, like, where we're not putting the entire blockchain in Mongo, it's performed really, really well. We are kind of pushing some of the limits of single instance Mongos with Bitcoin, and it's, you know, more full blockchain where we're putting every single transaction. into it, but we also have some of the sharded Mongo clusters that are load balanced, and those have done really well. So I think Mongo actually has a bad rap because it was really crappy for a number of years. But 3 or 4 years ago, I think they actually fixed the vast majority of their issues. As of the 3.0 and especially 3.2 releases, they completely re-architected the low-level database engine and the wire-tiger stuff, which is blazing fast. So it works if I would want to run like MapReduce jobs across Mongo, but for small to medium workloads, it's good. Like I said before, I got into the crypto stuff. I was doing more big data cloud computing and was using HBase and raw HDFS stuff for doing 100 petabyte type analytics jobs. And that would definitely be the way to go. If we ever have blockchain that big, we'll definitely have to look into better or horizontal scale like that. So far, so good. Yeah.
A couple of quick questions. So, can I understand like a two-factor authentication as a one kind of a multi-sec approach?
It could be.
Okay.
Yeah, so two-factor authentication, something that we require for pretty much any sensitive operation. But we consider that as like separate from multi-sig itself. We see it more as authenticating that you can now do one signature. Just make it harder for an attacker to be able to do the one signature and then request us to co-sign.
Okay. Another thing is because one of the lists that you can solve in terms of the questions, like the last one is phishing. Because a lot of exchanges are remind people to, hey, you want to enable two-factor authentication to avoid this type of the thing. So is a 2FA actually solving phishing problem?
Not really. So two-factor authentication will solve a number of issues of, say, if an attacker somehow gets your password.
Right.
Or if an attacker cracks your email account and manages to reset your password. It's really, it's bringing it back into the realm of physical security, especially if you're using a hardware 2FA. It says, cyber attacker out there can screw around with my accounts and try to get into them, but unless he physically gets my Yubi key or physically gets my phone or my time-based one-time password generator, then they're still not going to be able to get in. It's really just authenticating that you are you more than it is doing anything at the multi-sig level.
Okay, so basically 2FA is more related to the physical security part, right?
Yeah, so you can still get phished in malware. Users will get tricked.
Yeah.
We've still seen accounts of users who, they log in and put in their 2FA, and then either they send the money to a Nigerian scammer, or in the really crappy cases, there is a type of Windows malware that will actively listen for your copy-paste buffer. And if it sees a crypto address in your copy-paste buffer, it'll switch that out on you. So you then paste in the attacker's address, send to them, and you don't notice until the original counterparty says, hey, where's my money? Now, we've actually been able to have a little bit of success against that particular problem. And what we've done there is we've analyzed the malware that does the copy-paste buffer switcheroo, and we extracted all of their addresses, and we put that into our own BitGo policy that says, oh, you're trying to send it to one of these addresses? You might have gotten hacked, so we're going to stop you from sending that and alert you that you've got an issue you probably need to deal with. And I think last I checked, we hadn't run the analytics on it, but we saved tens of thousands of dollars worth of crypto assets from being sent to the malware office.
Thank you.
All right. Was there somebody in the back that I missed? Everybody's happy? All right. Questions for them?
announcement. We are working on a workshop where you can learn some of the different regulations and compliance issues around launching an ICO, and we're going to help you implement a token. So if you're interested in that, join the decentralized process Slack, and we'll be posting more info there. Besides that, we're going to be headed to Daedalus, I think it's called. It's a bar right around the corner around the area. And, yeah. So thanks everyone for coming.
Boston. You're
Hi, I'm Joe.
I had a guy who used this meetup a lot.